I'm Christopher Lydon, and this is Open Source. With the help of the Why Nations Fail economist Daron Acemoglu of MIT, and the hell-raising reporter at Rolling Stone magazine, Matt Taibbi, who has the nerve to write about a gangster state between Wall Street and Washington, we mean to stare down our feel-bad economy this hour. Facts and figures toward an alternative State of the Union, and feelings, too. Most people tell pollsters these days that they're not keeping up with inflation. More and more people describe themselves as lower middle or lower class. And then toward the bottom, there was the St. Anthony's Shrine downtown and a Roxbury Street corner with people braced for still another round of food stamp cuts.
The cuts are unnecessary. It ain't like they're giving out a great amount, you know? And you cut them, what do you expect them to do?
They told me I don't qualify for housing, for any help, because he told me my income is too high. I tell him I have child support, I have a daughter, I don't have a where I'm gonna live. And he said, I don't care, you don't qualify.
I'm letting a lot of things go, paying less on my bills to feed my family, because everything goes up, your rent goes up. Everything just goes up, and then nothing's coming down to meet the people's standard.
Someone should be doing more. You know what I mean? You can't put blame on Democrats or Republicans. I'm talking about just humanity as a whole, man. You know, I'll put aside the Democrats and Republicans and step up to the plate as a humanitarian and do what needs to be done for your people.
We're talking about the State of the Union as we see it every day, and we want to hear from you, listeners. 1-800-423-8255 is our number. 1-800-423-TALK. Our guest in the studio, Daron Acemoglu, wrote a very popular, influential, accessible, grand analysis of this problem 2 years ago. It was a global survey over 500 years of nations up, down, and over. The difference between happy and miserable nations, in a sentence, turned out to be openness and inclusion for systems of pluralism in power, for innovation and the common good. The opposite turns out to be an extractive politics for the benefit of an economic and power elite. In the U.S., you told me 2 years ago, Professor Acemoglu, we have already started the slide toward extractive institutions. Sounds like dentistry, and it's not pleasant. And it's not just the wealth inequality that has soared over the last 3 or 4 decades, you said. It's the eclipse of the myth and often the reality that average Joes rule our politics. You said you cannot say that today. Today, the political system, I believe, is largely just listening to the very rich. And now, well into President Obama's second term, deep in the doldrums of status quo, it would seem to me, how do you describe the state we're in?
Dangerous. It's great to be here, first of all, so thanks for having
me,
Chris.
Yeah,
I would describe it as dangerous. I think I stand by what I said 2 years ago. We are in the midst of a slide in the United States because economic inequality has surged so much. Economic inequality in every sphere of life has surged. The middle doesn't earn much. The top earns a lot. If you look at the top 1%, it earns a huge amount. 25% of all national income goes to the top 1%. If you look at the top 0.1%, it also earns a huge amount. About over 10 to almost 12% of national income goes to the 0.1%. And that has a fundamental impact on the way the economy is organized, who gets the benefits. Poverty is much higher than a country as rich and prosperous as the United States should really have. There are lots of children who don't have the right sort of medical care, the right sort of education, the right sort of access to public services. And more importantly, and this is related to your average Joe quotation, our politics has become much more unequal. And that's very dangerous because economic inequality is something we can try to deal with if we take the right policies, if we put the right educational institutions in place, if we have the right fiscal system. But when our political system becomes corrupted And this level of inequality has already corrupted it, and our legislations have already corrupted it because of campaign contributions, lobbying, and all the other relations between the rich and the powerful and the politicians. Then the problem becomes much worse because the rich and powerful now becomes even more powerful. They dominate politics. They can get the right legislation for themselves, the right policies, the right subsidies. They can become monopolies. They can make sure that their incomes, their profits aren't taxed, and that slides us further and further down these.
We should put this to music. I mean, this sounds like what people feel, I think. But what is the danger? Where is the brink? What happens next?
Well, there is no moment where we absolutely fall off the cliff. It's a continuous process. And I don't know where we are in that process. We've certainly started it, but I don't think we are very deep into it because the U.S. is still a very, very open society. We have a very vibrant media. We question it. Everybody talks about it. We owe a lot to the Occupy Wall Street movement. I don't think it was a very effective movement in terms of starting a new political party or a new political movement that was going to be durable. But it put the issue of inequality on the table. So you hear our president, you hear our congressman talk about inequality now all the time. New York Times, even Wall Street Journal is full of articles on inequality. So we are aware of it. So I think that's a very important part of diagnosing and perhaps dealing with the problem. And perhaps more importantly, the United States has been here before. We have experienced these levels of inequality. We've had much worse episodes of political inequality. Most importantly, at the end of the Gilded Age, we entered an era that was dominated by the robber barons. Income and wealth inequality was worse than now, but our political system was much more close. Senate wasn't directly elected, and everybody was talking about the treason of the Senate because the Senate was in the pockets of the robber barons. We did not have a regulatory state. We had no tools for dealing with monopolies and trusts. We had no federal income tax. We had no way of controlling risk-taking in the financial system. But the populist and the progressive movements produced three presidents and lots of legislatures that actually dealt with this problem to a large extent, not perhaps fundamentally, but to a very, very large extent.
You mentioned the Wall Street Journal. I have to note they had an interesting story this evening. The headline was Mancession Grips America, Mancession instead of Recession, and it spoke of 17% of working-age men being out of a job compared to just 6% in the 1970s. We'll get to the cutting edge of the media coverage of this story with Matt Taibbi, but go back one sec. Your colleague at MIT, Simon Johnson, is well known for having declared 3, 4, 5 years ago that we're a banana republic, essentially, except it's not bananas, it's bucks. He introduced this notion of state capture by an industry. And it feels right. They own the politics, they own the machinery, and God knows they own the wealth. What is your name for this condition, or do you have one? I mean, we go reflexively to oligarchy or plutocracy or winner-take-all politics. What do you call it?
I mean, I think an extreme form of it would be exactly that. Extreme form of it would be an oligarchy of the financial sector. Extreme form of it would be a banana republic or Wall Street republic. But I think that is something to be worried about. But we are not there yet. And I think there are three things to bear in mind. The first one is that finance is still hugely influential. Finance is still probably the most profitable industry in the world, in the United States. Finance still gives a huge amount of money to politicians, huge amount of money to both parties. There's an open door, revolving door policy relationship between finance, and finance has ideologically captured Wall Street. But again, when you look at the top list of the wealthiest Americans, only a handful of them are from the financial sector. So it's not that the entire business world of the United States is dominated by finance.
Warren Buffett is not a rarity exactly. I mean, you speaking of what? The alternative is there Bill Gates or
Bill Gates,
the new
Sergey
industrialists.
Brin, Larry Page, Jeff Bezos, the Walton family, the all of those are Larry Ellison. All of these people are, and I'm sure I'm forgetting another 30 who would be really offended that I have not put them in that top list of billionaires. But take away finance. take away finance and you have not solved the U.S. inequality problem. So it would be a mistake to think that the only reason why there is inequality in the U.S. is finance or Wall Street. Sure, Wall Street, I think, is creating a lot of problems. There's a huge culture and practice of risk-taking in Wall Street that's not accountable to anybody, and that has had a very, very important role to play in the run-up to the crisis and in our inability, perhaps, of shaking off some of the problems that we've had, for example, in the housing sector. But it would be also wrong to say that finance is accounting for all or even the major part of the inequality we're experiencing in the United States. The men session that you've mentioned, I think that is a very important part of it. What's going on is that a combination of technology and globalization is destroying the middle skill occupations that were the breadwinners for the men in the United States. And those jobs are disappearing. Machines are replacing them. Robots are replacing them. The Chinese are replacing them. And that is a very important contributor to inequality.
Let me ask you, if you saw the conditions that you're describing in the United States in Italy, say, or France or Canada, and you saw a kind of, I still think, a kind of torpid media and public response. This is not, there's no rioting in the streets. There's no champion out there of a major shakeup. What would you say to them?
Well, I would be very worried. I would be saying, you know, perhaps I'd be talking down to them and say, look, get your act together. There are some very worrying trends. And I think inequality is a very, very important problem. Inequality generally comes with two other very worrying trends. I've already mentioned one of them, political inequality, political capture, and I am really worried that a lot of that is going on. The other very important trend that inequality comes with, and I was very worried about this also, which is an inequality of opportunity, a real decline in social mobility. And Alan Krueger, who was the chief of economic, the chair of the Council of Economic Advisors until last year, talked about this as the Great Gatsby curve, that perhaps we are becoming a Great Gatsby society because inequality is so high, and that's depressing social mobility. Actually, recent research from Harvard says, well, social mobility is not doing so badly in the United States.
We're talking about the unequal economy in the United States, what feels like a capture of politics by money. Here is Franklin Delano Roosevelt on the eve of his re-election in 1936, speaking to a friendly crowd at Madison Square Garden. It's the bottom of the Depression, and FDR is talking about his opposition, notably bankers.
And we know now that government by organized money is just as dangerous as government by organized mob. Never before in all our history have these forces been so united against one candidate as they stand today. They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
Franklin Delano Roosevelt, 1936. Our phone is 800-423-8255. Matt Taibbi is on the line from New York, the muckraking writer and editor at Rolling Stone magazine. He's got a book coming out in the spring. It's titled The Divide. Matt Taibbi, you talk the FDR talk, but who else does? And why not?
There are a lot of politicians these days who are, you know, I would say, you know, talking about these issues, but there's nobody who's really taken the stride and tone, except for maybe an Elizabeth Warren, and occasionally, you know, Sherrod Brown, Jeff Merkley, Bernie Sanders. There's a small handful, but the political mainstream in this country, neither the Democrats nor the Republicans, have taken that tone with Wall Street in decades, and it's easy to see why. Wall Street has contributed heavily to both parties. Barack Obama, who is not considered any favorite of Wall Street by any stretch of the imagination, his number one private contributor in his initial election was Goldman Sachs.
Right.
So there isn't that kind of tone taken by a mainstream political party against Wall Street. Now, there's only small minorities within the House and the Senate and individual politicians.
Would it work, do you think? And what if the Democrats let somebody like Rand Paul, grab the flag before they do?
I think that would be a terrible mistake, and I think that political opportunity is out there for a politician who would be brave enough and bold enough to take up that mantle. In fact, after the crash of 2008, I talked to a lot of people on Wall Street, people who work on Wall Street, who were extremely disappointed in Barack Obama because they felt that this was precisely the moment where America needed a politician with superior communication skills like Obama to kind of stand up and explain what had happened in the crash leading up to 2008, and what was the cause of a lot of the inequality. And instead, they didn't really do that. They kind of papered over the problem with the bailouts. They essentially just threw a gigantic amount of public treasure at the financial services sector, and kind of went back to the status quo instead of having that teaching moment, which would have been really useful for the whole country.
Matt Taibbi, what do you call this condition we're in? You've called it gangsterism from time to time in that marvelous long piece on Goldman Sachs, but how do you describe it, and what's the short form around the Taibbi dinner table about how we got here?
You know, it's funny. I lived in Russia for 10 years, and that experience, I lived in Yeltsin's Russia in the 90s, and they had a term for this called prekhvatizatsiya, which is a kind of a play on the word privatization, but it also essentially means stealitization. It's a cross pollination of two words to steal and to privatize, and that's kind of the way I look at this situation. I think it's a kleptocratic state. I don't think we're quite at the level of being an out-and-out banana republic that's controlled by an oligarchy yet. I agree completely with Professor Acemoglu that we're not there yet. We still have a very vibrant, in some ways, democracy. We have a media that still functions in some degree. But we're heading in that direction, certainly. I think there's a tremendous amount of inequality. And a lot of the things that I saw over in the actual third world, in the former Soviet Union, we are starting to see over here.
Interesting. Professor Acemoglu is smiling broadly as you talked about the Russian kleptocracy. Do you want to join that, Daron?
Yeah, I mean, I think, I think that's a lovely metaphor. But we're not there yet because part of the reason we're not there yet is that despite all of that money, and despite all of that influence that Wall Street has, we have a very heterogeneous business elite. If you talk to people in Silicon Valley, they hate Wall Street. They are trying to pull in a totally different direction. And in the top list of billionaires, there are as many and many more people from Silicon Valley. And if you talk to people who are running our biotech industry or nanotech industry in Boston, they are not in sync with Wall Street. So I think we have to be very vigilant. There is a real danger that we could actually slide that way. And I think we are starting to deal with it, but in a very, very partial way. I think it is very, very important. It's very symbolic that JP Morgan is paying something between $10 to $20 billion. That's a huge amount of money. Now, is that enough? Well, they are still awarding huge bonuses to their to Jamie Dimon, so that means that they think it's not that bad, but it's a step in the right direction.
This is where it gets interesting, and you're in the thick of it, Matt Taibbi. I mean, you're lambasting Jamie Dimon and JP Morgan for showering him with fresh money in a kind of defiance. It's almost a contempt of the penalties that the bank is paying. How does this work? Are they listening? Do they read you, Matt Taibbi? Are they listening to the returns?
I think this is all part of and parcel of a kind of conscious policy doctrine that the Justice Department has settled into over the years. Eric Holder, way back in the Clinton administration, actually wrote a paper trumpeting a thing called collateral consequences. And the idea here was that if you had a big company that employed a lot of people, that it wasn't always a good idea to pursue criminal investigations of companies. They were talking about not criminally indicting companies because that might result in too much damage to a vibrant economic employer. But they've taken it one step further, and they're no longer even going after individuals at these companies. I think a great example, Chase. You know, they fined them $20 billion last year, but not a single person was indicted for any of the many scandals that they perhaps could have pursued criminal investigations in. Another great example was HSBC a year ago, which admitted to laundering $850 million for a pair of Central and South American drug cartels, and their only penalty was a 5-year deferred prosecution agreement. The only individual penalty that any of the executives had to suffer was that they had to partially defer their bonuses during that time period. Now, you think about that, that's a company that admitted to aiding and abetting at the very highest level of the illegal drug trade, and nobody does any time. Where you have our prisons in America are filled with people who are doing real time for possession, for much lesser crimes. So I think.
And remind me, what is the thinking there, and why does it seem to be so different from the disgrace that has been visited on comparable bankers in England?
Well, the thinking is that HSBC is a gigantic company that employs thousands of people, and their excuse was that if HSBC were to suffer a criminal indictment, that this would create global instability, and we might perhaps have another Lehman Brothers situation where one company goes under and that triggers a chain reaction of losses that sets off an entire global recession. But this has become an excuse to do nothing to any individuals who commit crimes in this sphere, and that sort of goes hand in hand again with what Professor Acemoglu was talking about, where it's not just income inequality, it's also political inequality, in this case, inequality of justice. These are similar problems, and they're just as pressing, I think.
Interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I totally agree. I think the contrast is most jarring with the very heavy-handed approach that the prosecutors are going after the Bitcoin operators, that because Bitcoin is used for marijuana purchases or something else, and look at what's happening. But I think this is very related to the issue that we were talking about, which is that there's an ideological sort of current now in policy circles that the financial sector is so important. We really depend on them for our recovery, and anything that goes against their interests could weaken the recovery or totally destroy it. And for that reason, we have to really stay away from doing any littlest amount of criticism or legislation against them.
Is that logical? I mean, has this industry earned the kind of protection you're talking about? I mean, what do they produce, after all? And if they were gone, beside the profits, which seem like casino profits, what would we be missing?
Well, I mean, I think there is some truth to it. That's the problem. And there's hugely exaggerated. But of course, finance is a hugely important industry. A lot of businesses borrow a lot. A lot of businesses depend on financial services for hedging their risks, for engaging in foreign transactions. And consumers borrow a lot. Our economy, we may not like that. We may want to change that in a structural way. But in the short run, our economy runs on borrowed money. So if the financial sector were to collapse completely, that would be a disaster. But the question is whether regulating, being tough against huge and irresponsible risk-taking is really something that's going to crowd out and totally destroy the good form of finance. And I don't really believe that. But it is something that you have to be careful. You cannot go after the entire financial system, and you cannot be so brazen that you kill finance.
Matt Taibbi, I've come to think of you as a sort of trash-talking Diogenes on Wall Street, looking for one honest man down there. You give it a sense that they're bad people.
Well, I just think that all of my sources are people who work on Wall Street. I mean, I didn't know anything about this entire world, and I got sucked into it after 2008 because there were people who worked in the industry who were appalled by the behavior of people within their own industry, and they were desperate for someone in the press to pay attention to the corruption that goes on in the financial services sector. So certainly they're not all bad people. And in fact, I would argue just the opposite, that, you know, the work that I do is reflective of a definite point of view among a significant plurality of people who work in this industry. And they're upset. I think, it makes it very difficult for honest companies to exist when corruption goes unchecked. And I think the problem with this idea that we can't regulate or this industry, and we can't press criminal cases in this industry, is that when they fail to do that the first time, like for instance in 2008 when they didn't go after the mortgage fraud abuses, pretty soon the next round of corruption was far, far worse. And we're dealing with scandals now like the LIBOR scandal and the foreign currency exchange scandal and the interest rate swap scandal. These are massive, collusive, antitrust, cartel-like scams that are far more serious than we saw before 2008. And I think that's a direct consequence of having not acted before, and that's a serious problem.
Professor Asimoglu.
Well, I mean, this is why institutions matter. This is the main idea that we've tried to push, James Robinson and I tried to push, in Why Nations Fail. You cannot, I don't know, there will be some people who are really so ethical, so wonderful in their values that they're always going to try to do the right thing. But you cannot expect all people to do that. That's why you need to have the right institutions, the right regulation, the right legislation. We really do depend on finance. But what that means is that we really have to regulate finance. We have to put the right rules so that the right form of finance, the good form of finance, flourishes, and the excessive risk-taking, the quasi-criminal, the quasi-destructive behavior doesn't flourish.
Matt Tabea, what's your sense of the, the real contribution of this industry? I mean, I have to say I'm skeptical. We never had as big or as rich or as, seductive a finance industry is this. It's, among other things, not least, it's just draining our campus talent the way the military. I mean, I remember Jerome Wiesner at MIT, Daron, talking about it broke his heart that in the 60s and 70s, the best people out of MIT, vast swaths of them, went into making weapons.
Well, actually, there's a student of ours who graduated last year, is now at Harvard Business School, Pian Shu, and her dissertation was focusing on MIT graduates. And when the financial sector doesn't do very well, so doesn't hire our undergraduates, they all go into engineering and they produce a lot of patents and a lot of knowledge. And when the financial sector booms again, they all get sucked into Wall Street and all of these patents, oof, they are gone.
So say something nice about it, that industry, Matt, just for the record.
No, I think in my experience, I've been enormously impressed by the creativity of the people who work in this industry, their ability to, the term they would use is create liquidity. They have an incredible knack for creating new financial innovations that allow them to have the money to finance new business ventures. The only problem is that they've also done a lot of things that are purely extractive, to use a term they used earlier in the broadcast, or exploitative. What happened before 2008 with the subprime mortgage bubble was purely a scheme to essentially suck money out of both ordinary homeowners and institutional investors like pension funds and foreign trade unions who were sold gigantic parcels of these fraudulent mortgage-backed securities. That entire subprime bubble added nothing valuable to society, and simply sucked a lot of wealth out of the country and the world, and stuck it in Wall Street. And I think it's the reputation of the entire financial services sector suffered because there's a perception now that they're not doing anything to create real jobs for ordinary people, that they're just engaged in money-making schemes for themselves. There isn't enough evidence to counter that. I think that perception is at least partly true now.
Yes, Professor Asimoglu, you call it, you lump it in with other extractive industries. There's no way to make it sound like a nice business. I mean, oil, yeah, it's necessary, and copper and coal and all sorts of other things get yanked out of the ground, but it's always somebody else's territory. It's rather an uncreative and, I don't know.
Undignified.
unhuman enterprise.
Well, these are all things we need to do, but these are the places that there is a lot of room for misbehavior. There is a lot of room for monopoly, risk-taking, doing things that ultimately create losses for the government or for other people. So regulation is really important. We have to regulate tobacco companies. We have to regulate oil companies, and we have to regulate finance. I think there is no doubt about that. But all of them, you know, perhaps not tobacco companies, but oil companies, you know, we do need oil. We do need energy. We want it cleaner. We want it extracted the right way, but we do need energy and we do need finance, but we've got to make sure that it's done the right way.
It's the combination of energy and finance that I hope we'll take up when we come back after break, because you sense that there is a new bubble, certainly a huge new Goldman Sachs empire being framed out there in fracking, in all kinds of new technology, what your colleagues at MIT call, what, the new machine age, which may be good, maybe not. I want to ask you both. We're talking about the economic doldrums and what feels like a flailing state. Here's another taste of FDR 1936.
I should like to have it said of my first administration that in it the forces of selfishness and of lust for power met their match. I should like to have it said, wait a minute, I should like to have it said of my second administration that in it these forces met their master.
We're talking about the U.S. economy. Give us the state of your union, please, with a call, 800-423-8255. Professor Daron Acemoglu in our studio, Matt Taibbi of Rolling Stone, on the phone from New York. Wouldn't you love to hear President Obama speak that way, Matt?
Yes, absolutely, but I don't...
Let them meet their master.
...terribly soon, but you know, he hinted at it, and in the State of the Union, I think they at least recognize the political necessity of talking like that, but I don't expect them to act to back that up with terribly aggressive action in that direction.
Daron, would it be good economics to have Wall Street feel the pressure of public outrage?
Sure, but I think, again, it would be insufficient, it would be wrong to just focus on Wall Street. We have more fundamental economic problems facing us. If we want to explain, if we want to understand, and if we want to rectify, why is it that we have largely stagnant or anemic wages for the middle class for the last 30, 35 years? That's not just about Wall Street. It's about our educational institutions. Our educational institutions are doing terribly. We don't have enough people going to college. We don't have enough people going to high school, especially men. We have lots of other things. We still have lots of inner cities where people don't graduate from high school. They graduate into jails.
Okay, but come back to my simple question. Seems to me the premise is that we've fetishized money, we've eroticized money, and we've cut taxes on the richest people in the world. Why wouldn't it be, you know, halfway there to raise their taxes back toward, you know, not quite to the dear old Eisenhower levels, but something, you know, marginal rates in the, you know, 30, 40, 50% or whatever, and invest that money in the schools that are desperately in need?
I mean, I think that we have to raise more taxes. United States needs more taxes. Well, the question is, what's the best way of raising that? I think U.S. economy can certainly withstand a few more percentage points of higher taxes on the richest people. But on the other hand, there are more efficient ways of dealing with that. For example, if we get rid of all of the loopholes that are benefiting hedge fund managers, that are benefiting top executives who leave their profits into their 401ks or other sort of tax-sheltered accounts, or leave profits in offshore so that they're not brought back to the United States and taxed, all of these loopholes create huge amount of public waste and are much more damaging to the economy. And in fact, we also have to think about what where does the U.S. leadership of the global economy come from? And the answer to that is innovation. U.S. is still, with all of its problems, the most innovative country in the world. If you look at the fundamentally transformative ideas in most industries, they come from the United States. So we have to think of a fiscal system that still incentivizes these entrepreneurs, these young people like Larry Page, Jeff Bezos, Sergey Brin, to take the risks that they do, because those are the good risks. Because if they fail, they fail and they lose their own money. And when they succeed, they create a lot of jobs. It's not like the subprime industry taking risks where when they fail, it's the government that picks up the tab. Those are the good sort of risks, and we have to encourage these people to take the good sorts of risks. If we increase marginal taxes on the successful entrepreneurs to 80%, that's going to start discouraging people. So we have to raise more taxes. We need more money for our schools. We need more money for our infrastructure. But we have to think about what's the best way of doing that.
I keep wondering, what's the obstacle to sort of reenacting the Oliver Wendell Holmes rule that taxation is the price of civilization, that we're all in this thing together? We absolutely have to train up the talent in a new generation. And of course we've got to do it together. And the assumption of that these immense capital gains will be taxed at 15% is an obscenity.
Well, you know, I think the labor income of many people is also being taxed at 15%, some of the richest people, because they can masquerade it as capital income. That's a huge problem. Capital income taxation is a more complicated issue, because you've got to make sure that you don't tax the savings of the middle class twice. So there are ways of dealing with that. We can have a much more rational, more redistributive, but less distortionary fiscal tax system. But unfortunately, neither Democrats nor Republicans want to touch that. You know, the Obama himself formed a committee to deal with that problem. But when the committee came back with certain good ideas, you know, he didn't want to touch it because it was a political landmine.
We know that there is a redistribution upward over the last 30, 40 years. Who's going to stop that? And that should be so simple through the tax code. How long can that pattern of the rich getting richer continue, quite literally?
Well, I think unfortunately it can continue for quite a while, because it's a combination of many things. Some of it is exactly because we've been treating the very rich very well. We haven't been taxing it. But more problematically, we've also been subsidizing risk-taking, as in the case of finance, as we talked about. And we've been not taxing huge amounts of profits because they are made abroad and they're not brought back. So there are real huge loopholes from which not just the financial sector, but companies like Starbucks, Google, Microsoft, Apple also hugely benefit. So we have to deal with these problems. But also we have to recognize that some of the forces that lead to greater inequality are technological. They are related to the more globalized nature of the world economy. And we have to think of what are the best ways of dealing with them. For example, we have to think about what does our educational system do? Our educational system is seriously failing. And even when it doesn't fail, it doesn't give the right sort of skills, because it gives skills and a mental attitude to our students, especially to male students in the United States, that prepares them for the jobs of the 1960s and the 1970s, jobs that don't exist anymore. And we have a labor market which at the bottom doesn't pay very well. And we have to think of ways of dealing with that, a combination of earned income tax credit and moderate increases in minimum wages, for example, so that wages, earnings at the bottom of the income distribution are rewarding. So those are very, very different approaches, complementary approaches to just worrying about the very, very rich fat cats in Wall Street. You want to worry about risk-taking in Wall Street, but that's a very small part of the big economic picture that the United States
has. We want to deal with all of it. We're very happy to be taking calls again for the first time in this radio reincarnation. The phone is 800-423-8255 or 800-423-TALK. Nick is on the line from Brookline, Massachusetts.
Hi, Chris. How you doing?
Welcome, Nick. Excellent.
I've been listening to you since The Connection. From that long ago.
Amen. You got a star.
I'm so glad you're on the radio.
Thank you.
Anyhow, I'm really enjoying the conversation. I really feel honored to be in the presence.
You're the first, Nick.
Oh, that's great. Now, quick question, okay? I noticed that the right has their form of sort of a person for the everyman in the Ted Cruz's, in Rand Paul's, and all the kind of wacko Tea Party guys that say crazy stuff that find their way on MSNBC. And I'm just wondering why the left wing doesn't have you hear FDR speak, and it just your blood boils because you're just so excited that you have such a champion on your behalf. Mm. I'm just wondering why that just doesn't exist now, when the right apparently doesn't have any problem co-opting the poor primarily to support people who I see just to be minions of the rich. So I was just hoping you could be able to address that. Thank you.
Matt Taibbi, that's for you.
Yeah,
Nick, thank you.
Nick, that's a great question, because I was just going to bring this up before when Professor Acemoglu was talking, that we have this additional issue here in the States where we have this enormously successful kind of pseudo-grassroots movement on the right that has been this Tea Party movement that has been cooked up to justify, not just to justify, but to promote the idea that taxation of the so-called producers of society is dangerous, is regressive, it's un-American, and it's become politically very dangerous for anybody who's running for office to come out and say that they're in favor of raising taxes in order to kind of put it restrict the growth of the very rich and to put a brake on inequality. I think that's one of the reasons why you've seen this enormous enthusiasm of right-wing politicians. They're able to kind of let it all hang out when they talk about this issue. But on the other side, except for with a very few exceptions, with people like Elizabeth Warren, for the most part, Democratic politicians are afraid of being branded as anti-capitalist, as leftist, mm-hmm. as communist, and so they don't use incendiary language when they talk about things that really are outrageous. And that's become a major weakness, I think, of the other side. I think there's a way to talk about these issues without coming across as an out-and-out socialist, but they just haven't been able to connect to the outrage that really is out there in society.
That's fascinating, but can I just suggest that it seems to me Rand Paul, on his better days, can be more promising to me than Bernie Sanders as a leader. On a lot of things, he and our pal Ralph Nader agree, not only with a tendency to be anti-corporate and libertarian, but also anti-imperial, anti-drone war. They can be humane too. And I'm fascinated by the convergence of what can seem fringy people from both ends.
Well, I mean, just a great example of that was when Ron Paul and Bernie Sanders got together to audit the Fed, which had never been done in the entire history of the Fed, and despite the tireless efforts of people like Wright Patman, who was a congressman who tried forever to get the Fed to open its books and never succeeded, but after the crash, this coalition of
yes.
kind of libertarians on the one side and progressives on the other side managed to force open the Fed's books, and through that we found out about $16 trillion of lending that had gone out to the financial sector and to other parts of the economy that we wouldn't have known about otherwise. And I think you're absolutely right that there's a lot of energy to be taken advantage of there through that kind of coalition. It's just that we haven't found consistently a way to do that yet.
Daron Acemoglu, are you for prying open the Fed?
Well, I wholeheartedly agree with what Matt said. I mean, I think, when we were talking of the political inequality and political capture, what that means is that the rich and the powerful are able to capture the government. So it's the government employees, politicians, bureaucrats, together with the rich that are doing things that they shouldn't be doing. And then you have people touching one side of the elephant, then they say the problem is the very rich. And another set of people who are touching another side, and they say the problem is the government. And when you look at the Tea Party's one wing, as you said, Rand Paul saying it's a problem with the government helping the very rich, it's a problem with the corporations, and we need more sort of freedom to deal with these problems. But the problem, of course, is that the Tea Party now is something entirely different. It's an anti-immigration. It's become very much an extreme wing of the Republican Party. But I entirely agree with Matt that you need a broad coalition. That's another one of the ideas, a buzzword, so to speak, of our book. book, of James and my book, Why Nations Fail, that you need a broad coalition, and a broad coalition consisting of people from the right, from the left, from the libertarians, from the socialists, from the social democrats, coming together and wanting better governance, better institutions, better rules, better economics, I think is much more promising.
This reminds me, though, Matt, I want your take on the next bubble and the next Goldman Sachs adventure in fracking and in the related discoveries and investments in new energy.
Well, I don't know so much about fracking, but I do hear a lot of people on Wall Street wonder about the next bubble and the next correction. And one of the things they talk about a lot is the quantitative easing policy, where the Fed is, you know, pumping, it was originally $85 billion a month into the economy, now it's $65 billion. You know, you couple that with the fact that money is basically free for the financial sector, there's zero interest lending. So there's this endless kind of faucet of government/Fed largesse that's being pumped into the economy, and it's forcing people to chase yield and to go into riskier and riskier investments, emerging markets, subprime mortgages again. The problem is when that faucet gets turned off again, is there going to be a correction? Are prices, are all of these investments going to lose their value because that money isn't there anymore? I think there's a lot to worry about there. People haven't really been paying a lot of attention to it, but this idea that we're propping up the economy by printing $65 billion a month and shoving it into the financial bloodstream of the country, that's disturbing, and that's something we have to worry
about. Does it take that kind of pumping, Professor Acemoglu, to put the United States out front or in a place that the global economy needs it?
I'm not sure. I think a lot of economists are thinking that, you know, quantitative easing had already run into diminishing returns, but wasn't so effective. But Matt is right. I think financial markets were the main constituency of quantitative easing. And when the quantitative easing ceases, there is going to be an adjustment from the financial markets. We're already seeing that in the emerging markets. There's all this hot money going into emerging markets that's now pulling out, and a lot of emerging markets are having trouble. I think quantitative easing isn't the solution to our structural problems. We have structural problems. We have to have long-term solutions to them.
We are warned of the serious dangers. Thank you, Daron Acemoglu. Thank you, Matt Taibbi. Thanks also to Father Joe Quinn and the staff at the St. Anthony Food Center in Boston. Listeners, you can continue this conversation on our website at radioopensource.org. You'll find all sorts of other conversations and discussions there, including the third in our series called Reading Chekhov and a story called Gusev. Next week, Boston Noir. This show is produced by Max Larkin and Kunal Jasti. George Hicks is our man at the radio controls. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next week on Open Source.
Say, you know, there's a new day coming. Come on, as sure as you're born. There's a new day coming. My Teddy's gonna stop tooting his horn. While the cobbler's shoeing, the bakers will bake. Oh, ho! When the brewer's brewing, folks, we'll all get a break. Yes, sir, a new day's coming for Levy and Burke. A new day's coming for the boss and for the clerk. Oh, no more bumming, no, sir, we'll all go to work. There's a new day coming soon.